Was advertised about bridging gaps between broom and non-broom, and that's obviously something that I'm involved with and extensively because of Awesome, and it's really following in the footsteps of the legacy of Awesome as a whole. This is where it all began, and this is really an extension of that. It's walking in the footsteps essentially of Jack, and we have Ivan, by Shane, and Austin, and all those involved at Platzko at an earlier stage. So whatever I'd stop it, it's been experienced in terms of us as well, like by Edmondson and the rest of our amazing team, is really just symptomatic of the legacy that we've begun many, many years ago. And we've got a tremendous amount of aids and perspective from all of them. What's also amazing is that most people that are even standing in this room I know personally have some sort of personal process and journey that they went through with Awesome Earth itself. So it's not something that's foreign to anybody in terms of appreciating the process of going through to Shula. And that's in a much more explicit sense or much more intensive sense, but that's in its mitzvahs, I say, in the Torah for everybody to do to Shula. Sometimes you think that like we're either about to Shula or we're from birth, and therefore, if you're from birth, you never have to go through a Shula process, and if you're about to Shula, so then you did. And then once you are about to Shiva, which is the worst part of it, besides the question of Yichus and things like that, people think that they've made it. They're like, now I keep Shabbos and kosher and I do a Davin and Minyan, so therefore we still run about to Shiva. I'm done to Shiva. In reality, there's a mitzvah, I say, and this process of Elul is relevant to everybody, irrespective of background, and therefore I think categorization is dangerous. I think that's maybe the first premise that needs to be considered, which is maybe more profound than one might think, that when one likes to put everything in a specific silo or box category, one dangerously creates borders and boundaries that are artificial, that aren't really there. Because everybody's going through a journey, and nobody's exempt from this journey, and everybody has to grow, and everyone has to develop. And if everybody has that mentality, it's easier to consider another person being in a similar context to you. Mashaikai, or else, if I'm from and I'm not, that already creates a certain sense of distinction or discrepancy, which is a hurdle that one has to overcome. It's not really real. Not from a Hashem's point of view, anyway. That's important to consider, just as a first point. And as much as we like it to be real, in reality it isn't. That's maybe the first of it. And we also have no clue where Hashem is considering everybody in terms of their level. We have to just...
That's important to consider, just as a first point. And as much as we'd like it to be real, in reality it isn't. That's maybe the first Nakuda. And we also have no clue where Hashem is considering everybody in terms of their level. We have to just all be in a process of growth and let that be as contagious as possible. That's maybe point number one. The main source in the whole of the Mishnah and the Midrash that describes the process of Elul is a source from Rabbi Eliezer. It's a group of Midrashim called Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. And the Tur brings that down in the beginning of Hilchos Rosh Hashanah. And he says like this, he says, Tanya bePirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, Barosh Chodesh Elul, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe, Ala Ala Ahara, come to me on the mountain, and then you'll come to get the second set of tablets, and you'll be able to bring a shofar amongst the camp. And the reason why Moshe went up and that they blew the shofar was that they didn't land up falling again from the sin of the golden calf, which had taken place, which ultimately necessitated the tshuva process from the beginning of Rosh Chodesh Elul, culminating on the 10th of Tishrei, which is Yom Kippur, where we received the second Luchos, right? That was Matan Torah Sheini, so to speak. Lachai nitkinu chachamenu, and therefore Chazal established sheyu toikim b'Rosh Chodesh Elul, that we start blowing a shofar b'chol shana v'shana, every year b'chol chodesh kedai liyizhar Yisrael she'ashu tshuva, so that Yisrael lands up being conscious of doing teshuva. Shenemar im yitke shofar ba'ir Should I sound a shofar amongst the city and the nation not be experiencing some sort of trepidation? And also to confuse some sort of negative force in reality, to try and be repel that force, even though the word Rav Moshe Shapiro wanted to say Zatzal, that La'arbev is a bit ambiguous over here, which means to mix. Anyway, another time. V'kainu agin, and therefore we have the minag leim lahakol. And therefore they had a minag to blow the shofar every morning and every evening in Ashkenaz. And those who make slichos and tachanunim from Rosh Chodesh Elul and onwards, like Sfaradim do. And it goes on to describing this very extensively. The bottom line is this, and this is what I wanted to try and explore today, is what is the underlying premise of the shofar regarding this idea? How does the shofar play such a primary role? If you look at a shofar from an anthropological point of view, in other words, if you're a person just observing religion, you'd think that this is about stimulating a certain consciousness and awareness, which is seemingly what the Rambam says as well. But it doesn't seem to have anything more than that. Like, what's the idea? Is it just to create a certain Uri Yishani Mishnoi Seichem? Just get up, all you slumberers, from your shlof. But is there something deeper? Because it's a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah in the Torah, at least on Rosh Hashanah. It's a mitzvah. It's a very important mitzvah. And the minag is already over 3,500 years old. It's one of the earliest minagim we have. So literally, before we receive the second set of luchos, we already had a minag to blow the shofar the whole of Elul. It's quite an amazing thing. We don't have so many old minagim like that. Now that's one question. As an aside, hopefully we'll bring it all together. As an aside, one could ask this. When we do teshuvah, what is our perspective on teshuvah? And I feel once we have a clarity on this, it will really help us to maybe have some sort of effectiveness in terms of being involved with other people besides ourselves. You see, usually the perspective around teshuvah is that I've done something wrong that needs to be fixed. And in order to fix it, I have to turn over a new leaf. And once I've turned over a new leaf, my relationship to the past is one in which I've grown, I've changed, and since abandoned the past. Because we all want to be cleansed. We want to be cleansed to such an extent that we have no like reflection of the past, because the past was something that we don't want to associate with on the basis that it was a breakdown, it was spiritually negative, it is in disassociation to Hashem. So what we want to do is, when we do teshuvah, is we want to come to some sort of state of being in which our past is rubbed out. Yes? That's what the Rambam also says in Hilchos Teshuvah. He says that when you do teshuvah, it's as if all your vows were like basically like they didn't count. You've never done them ever. And that's such a nice feeling. I want to ask though this. Firstly, how does that work? How is it possible to undo the past? It's, conceptually, I could understand that you could move away from the past in terms of your futuristic behavior. In other words, from now onwards, I don't do anything. But what's done is done. How do you have some sort of retroactive or some sort of undoing of past behavior? Unless you're like a big fan of Michael J. Fox and going into the DeLorean and going back in time into some sort of Back to the Future reality, how on earth does that work? Or is it just some sort of miraculous reality? Just some sort of miracle that God discredits all your past misdoings? But it's difficult, right? It's difficult to say that what's done, it was. That's what we say about everything in our relationships with people. Forgive but don't forget. You know, suddenly when it comes to it, we say, forgive and forget, and actually make pretend it didn't happen. It didn't happen at all. That's our relationship with Hashem, which is difficult. But the Gemara says that. The Gemara Masechet Yomah says that when we do teshuva meira, then our intentional sins become considered unintentional. If we do teshuva because we're scared of the implications of our actions, and we're scared God's going to punish us. So we do teshuva. So then our mezidim become shkagos. Our purposeful actions become considered basically unintentional. Which is also difficult to understand. That's one question. And what happens if you do teshuva ma'ava? Does anyone know that Gemara? The Gemara says if you do teshuva ma'ava, then your intentional sins become considered schuyot. It doesn't say mitzvahs, but it says schuyot, which means meritorious. In other words, the pashtus of that Gemara is, again, we can reinterpret as much as we like, but the simple interpretation of that Gemara is that it was a good thing that you did those bad things, because they geared you and led you to a point in which now you're ultimately in a position in which these things represent some sort of positive gain. In other words, not only have you gone back into the past and rubbed out the past, you've reorientated the past in a way in which it's now turned out to be beneficial. Now that's very difficult conceptually to orientate and to conceptualize. How do you work that out? Your behavior was terrible. It was an avera be'etzim. You did it purposefully. Now, the schus, a ganzen schus. It's very difficult to understand. So why do you blow a shofar? And how is it possible that somehow you're able to reorientate your whole past? That's the third question. That's the second question. And third one is the Gemara in Masechta Brochas that says that a tzaddik gamur can never stand in the place of a baal teshuvah. A person who's never sinned his entire life has the inability to stand in the place of a baal teshuvah. Rav Dessler has a beer on it. Other people have a beer on it. But once again, the pashut pshat of the Gemara is that a certain darga of Kedusha and closeness to Hashem can only be attained by a person who's gone through a tshuva process. That's also difficult to understand. The Rambam goes into it, he says, because you've tasted sin, you've experienced sin, and now you've gone against that. But on a deeper level, what's going on over there? In other words, it seems to even suggest, which is Chalil the MS, but that like there's some sort of benefit of doing avaras and then coming back. We don't ever intentionally go out to do such a thing. But if we're in that process, which we all are, unless you're not, and then your stomach's not, it's not the forum for you, you should be teaching, and that's it. But unless everyone's in a process of doing teshuva and needing to improve themselves, so then there's an ability to attain a certain level of connection to Hashem which was not possible if you had not done the thing that was wrong. How does that work? But it correlates, obviously. Alright, so just to spell this out in a certain way, Rav Moshe wanted to say a yesod, a very important principle. I'd like to explain that, explore that, and then hopefully give you some practical experiences of that or reflections of that from modern day achronim. Even though Rav Moshe is also one, but other people that said it in a different way. So Rav Moshe said that he quotes the Ramban at the beginning of his Drosh and Rosh Hashanah. So the Ramban, and the Kitvei Ramban. The Ramban says that the source for the shofar is a pasuk in Iyov. The reason why we know the shofar, the thematic representation of the shofar, is a pasuk in Iyov. And the pasuk says, Baruch Shamayim Shifra, that with wind the heavens will become illuminated. So the word shofar comes to the word shifra, which means to illuminate, to expose. And he says, Rashi over there on that pasuk, Baruch Shamayim Shifra, says that the context is a very, very cloudy day with the inability to see based upon the fact that it's dark. Suddenly the winds come and it reorientates the heavens in a way in which the sun shines through. And because the sun shines through, now there's clarity. So what the shofar represents is the portrayal of clarity. And that's essentially the thematic expression of Rosh Hashanah as a whole. The David Hashem Oiri, the Yishi Oiri is Rosh Hashanah. The light is Rosh Hashanah. Everything about Rosh Hashanah is about light. And it's about exposure and clarity. Yeah? Even in the context of Kabbalah Satoira, we speak about the blowing of the shofar itself also and the removal of the smoke over there. It's always in the context of clarity and with the exposure of clarity. But he says something a lot deeper. This is what we need to work on today. Hopefully I'll have enough source to be able to make it clear the way he does. He says the gematria of the word Elul is Bina. Bina. And this sounds very disparate, but hopefully everything will come together. The gematria of the word Elul is Bina. Bina is one of the 10 Sfirot. It's one of the 10 emanations of Hashem. And he says that there's a pasuk, which is true. The makor for the mitzvahs asay of teshuva is in Parshat Naso. The Zohar in Parshat Naso says that the way to express the mitzvah of teshuva is through bina. So bina, this type of what we loosely translate as understanding, epitomizes the medium to acquire teshuva. So you have to have bina, which women have more of, according to the Gemara. The Gemara Masechet Nida, Daf Mem Hei. Bina Yisrael, women have bina Yisrael. But either way, this is the expression of teshuva, to acquire this concept called bina. And that's what we need to acquire, and that's the elul medium. What is bina? Parshas Ki Tisa, we see Rashi over there explaining bina in the context of the Hakamata Mishkan, and the building of the Mishkan, where we see over there Metzalel being described as having Chochma Bina and Da'at. And when he's described as having Chochma Bina and Da'at, over there Rashi explains that Chochma is basically first principles. It's the idea that you would have not been able to attain on your own, the concept as a whole that you need to acquire from somebody else. And then Bina is what's called Mevin Dava Mitoch Dava, which means to be able to extrapolate information or to be able to categorize and contextualize what you understand. Bina is we're able to apply what you know, applied knowledge. And on the basis of being able to understand something properly, explains Rav Moshe, then you're able to also contrast it with what it isn't. Maybe from another angle, the Gemara in Masechet Megillah on Daf Yud Aleph says that Daniel the prophet miscalculated when the rebuilding of the second temple would occur. The rebuilding of the second temple was predicted to occur 70 years after the destruction of the first. So over there, in that context, everybody started celebrating amongst the Goyim, especially Achashverosh and friends, when they gathered in all the utensils of the Beis HaMikdash in order to celebrate the fact that the first temple was not going to be rebuilt in 70-year lapse, because they counted and it didn't. So they took all the Kalim and they started to celebrate. And that was the party of Achashverosh. And the Gemara over there says that everybody miscalculated. Not only everybody, even Daniel the prophet. And how do we know? Afilu Daniel toye, shene'emar binoisi. He understood. Miklal shehu toye. Therefore we know that he made a mistake. And therefore came Rav Moshe Shapiro and he said something which is so tremendous and so fascinating and needs real elucidation. He says that any understanding requires error, or to be clearer, requires contrast. If you really want to understand something, you have to be able to differentiate it from what it isn't. And the more refined your knowledge of anything is in life, the more you are able to know what it isn't. It's almost like, if one were to be a bit crude with the description, to conceptualize and categorize in any type of process requires a certain degree of background and knowledge and sophistication. And the more sophisticated you are, the more you're able to really understand something. So for example, a banana. So if you went up to a person or a monkey, and the person was basically a monkey, so all his relationship to a banana would be similar to a chimpanzee, which would be some sort of nourishment. But the more that we grow as human beings, we're able to conceptualize and categorize it as being very specific things. So if you were to speak to a person in the context of dietetics, that person would be able to tell you that a banana is potassium, it's a carbohydrate, it has sugar, it's able to affect you in a particular way, it helps with muscular cramping, hence tennis players use it in the middle of a game of tennis, right? These are ramifications and results of sophistication. But what they do is they also contrast a banana to an apple. And that's why you won't see any tennis player using an apple when they're sitting on center court in order to try and regain some sort of fueling and simultaneously correct cramping, because they know that potassium isn't in an apple to the same extent that it is in a banana. But that's all within the realm of dietetics and sports science. If you were to speak to a person who's a culinary expert and you were to say, what is a banana? They'd say, well, either it's a dessert or it's a garnish in the context of some sort of sophisticated curry. But it's something that becomes very, very nuanced. If you spoke to a person who's in the world of science and genetics, suddenly a banana now becomes a molecular structure with all atomic makeup and all different variations within the world of science and genetics and all things of that nature and physics. So what is a banana? It depends. But it depends on your background and it depends on to what extent you're sophisticated. But until you have that sophistication, it's all a haze. And in order to get the thorough distinctions, you need to go through a process of always ruling out what it isn't. And that's what categorization is. There's even something I learned at university, which is tremendous in terms of modern day technology. They found out that facial recognition actually works through the process of exclusion as opposed to the process of acquisition. In other words, when you look at a person, you're able to recognize them. You're going through a process of exclusion of every other person that you recognize in order to eliminate and isolate that person, as opposed to just knowing them for them. But if you think about it conceptually, that's the way we understand everything in our minds. The way we understand everything is by categorization. And what categorization is excluding it from all the other things in your mind. That's what logic is. That's what any type of framing is. It's very difficult to explain this in 15 minutes and to sell it. But this is very, very sophisticated conceptually, and this is what Rav Moshe wanted to understand. In other words, what he wanted to explain was that when you want to understand something on the most acute level, you have to be much more acute at knowing what it isn't than just knowing what it is. That's always the acquisition of something. Do you want to know what this means? This is the chap. He says, when a person has a relationship to a mitzvah, so why should you do a mitzvah? You should do a mitzvah because it's a good thing. You should do a mitzvah because it's important to do it, because Hashem wants you to do it. So now let's step into a dirty world. So, at all the high schools, they have these lecturers that are lecturing on the vulnerability and dangers and pitfalls of drug abuse and drug experimentation. So you get all these people to come and listen, and who do you get to speak? Usually, more often than not, you don't get a person who's a pharmacologist, and you don't get you get a recovering addict. That's right. Why do you get a recovering addict? So the conventional wisdom is to say, because he can describe to you how horrible it is to be a drug addict. And he'll scare you, because he'll give you a very vivid impression as to the vulnerability of what it means to be a drug addict. There's a deeper pshat, and this is what I wanted to convey. The recovering addict is not just able to give you a much more vivid impression as to what it means to go down that dark road. The recovering addict has a much deeper appreciation for sobriety than you do. His relationship with sobriety and yours are very different. In other words, because he's experienced a contrasting reality, which has on some level exposed him to breakdown and tragedy and all types of horror, he has a relationship with the opposite, which is very different to what you have. Even though you're both sober right now, which is so profound. It's like it's paradoxical in a sense. You're in the exact same reality, and the one has a much deeper appreciation than the other, even though it's identical. So the chapa over here is this. When a person goes down a dark road, but they go back to the other side, the dark road sheds a new light on the light. It gives a clarity that would not be available and would not be viable unless there was a contrast. There's a new chap. You can chap the appreciation for mitzvahs and the appreciation for wholesome values if you've lived a life of breakdown. Much more so than if your life's always been very wholesome and very good. In other words, contrast is very, very critical in order to have a greater appreciation for things. That's similar on a much more cliched level to saying you only appreciate what you lose. Because now you realize that you've lost it. So there's a certain degree of contrast. You have a reflection. So with that in mind, on a deeper level, that works in terms of conceptually grasping anything. That the grasp of a subject, the grasp of any principle, is dependent on to what extent there's an exclusion. And the more the exclusivity, the greater the refinement. And the greater the refinement, the greater the sophistication. And within that framework, there's the wherewithal to appreciate and to connect to that thing on a much deeper level. On one level, it's emotional appreciation or gravitation. On another level, it's intellectual grasp. Purest intellectual grasp. It's all about exclusion. It's in a certain sense, that's why the mind works through cutting things down. Like if you look in a Gemara, it's all about cutting things down and breaking it up and breaking it down and breaking it down. And the more refined, the more you break it down. It's very, very cool. That's called exclusion. Within the context of teshuva, The exclusion process is a process in which you have to contrast what it isn't. But here's the chap. Okay, if we've got that until now, it's unbelievable. But I feel the implication is quite tremendous. And this is where we all go wrong, in a sense. So much, and it's not for me to say. Rav Soloveitchik said it so beautifully. He says, if this is true, so then all your process of breakdown is supposed to enable you to be closer to Hashem. And he says, you know what people end up doing when they go through the process of recovery, or they go through the process of elevation, the spark breakdown? They put it in a closet and it becomes a skeleton. It becomes the skeleton which people want to hide and pretend doesn't exist. Our natural coping mechanism to the process of growth is that we want to disassociate from our past in a way in which it's an embarrassing dream, an embarrassing nightmare, that we want to be as far away from as possible. And that's the way we can go forward with this sense of pride, of purity, that, so to speak, disassociates from any association to the past misgivings and shortcomings.
Why is a Baal Teshuva called a Baal Teshuva?
Ma?
Ma, say, what is a Baal Teshuva? Why do you have to regret your past? Not necessarily,
it's
habits.
בדיוק, אבל זה הכוונה שלי. אבל זה לא מה שאנשים עושים. That's what I'm trying to say. People don't do that. People want to disassociate from the body. So you know what Rav Soloveitchik says? He says, you're disarming yourself, and this is what Rav Rechler wants to say in a different way. You're disarming yourself from all your past achievements and all your past growth in a way in which you try and create this pseudo-spiritual status which is now, so to speak, always, you're always there. You were born nimel. Like Moshe Rabbeinu in the Gemara and Sota, right? You were born basically with a bris, and there was all just pouring out of you, and there was no association to the past. So you know what Rav Lochte says, all your koiches that you've acquired, you've run away from. All your experiences that have made you you, which have given you the armory to deal with so many circumstances in your future life, and to help, and this is the chap, and to help others with their process, you are disassociating from on the pure basis of some sort of holier-than-thou stance. So Soloveitchik says, it's a total discredit to your process, and in a certain sense, it's such a chaval, because that's why you now have these amazing levels of acquisition. And you weren't a tzaddikam. You're a Baal Teshuva. You're in a place that is just unbelievable, but you need to utilize that and embrace it in a way in which it becomes an educational tool for yourself. This is what Rav Lochte says, because he says you will experientially re-experience things and you need to come back onto how you dealt with it previously, how you grew from it previously, but certainly to give to others. There needs to be your only process of how you need to give to others is just to reflect on you. Don't come onto any book. Just shed upon your life growth experience, because it's the most authentic, it's the most real, and it doesn't at any level need to be canned or contrived. It's just you. And that is the most tasteful, resonating experience to invest and convey to other people. But it's something in the modern world which is a little bit taboo. Now that doesn't mean, on the other hand, that a person has to stand from the chandeliers and describe every single bad thing that they've done. Not everybody has to be that recovering drug addict and expose all of himself. But on the other hand, the principles that one used and the inner strength and the courage and the conceptual grasp of the values, that's something that needs to come over in a very real way. And if you can't give that over, so then who are you? You like run away from yourself, so to speak. So that, in a sense, was one of the principles that is brought out by this concept called Bina. Bina means that you have to use your negative experiences to contrast the positive. But it's not to run away. This is the chap, which is quite difficult, because when we're in a guilt mode, we want to totally, in our minds, run away from that reality. That's not the chap. You have to be courageous enough to relate and embrace, if that's even possible, but at least to confront your reality in a way in which it lands up making you much more of a Kaddish human being.
He's saying expose your vulnerabilities.
Not, but to you. But to you. Expose your vulnerabilities to yourself.
So you're going to use it as a springboard and go further, is that right?
That I wouldn't, again, I'm not saying therefore that a person should have, it's not therapy. So saying like, I also suffer from this. We all suffer. If we know any Gemara, we know, if anybody's here greater than that other person you're trying to be metapel with, then you have a greater Yetzer than them. And if you have a greater Yetzer with them, you're still going through your own sugyas. So that's the reality. So that's poshut. You don't have to go through that. But what a person has to do is more is use their tools in their own personal process of teshuvah. This is what Ramoshi said for us. Now, Elul, we have to use Bina. What's Bina mean? It means think about your challenges and use them as a way to connect to your mitzvahs. Not to try and wipe them out. It's a very different chap. It makes you less... It's almost like otherwise it's so cutthroat. And it's so black and white in a non-human way. That's not a human being and that's not what a person is. And then if you do that, more often than not, it just gets buried. And it festers. And eventually then it just lands up coming to the fray again anyway. What you need to do in order to create a holistic shift is a person needs to embrace the realities of negativity in a way in which it said much greater light. The way the Balatanya explains it is beyond beautiful. He says, every relationship with the Rabbeinu Sholem is this rope. We're holding the one side and he's holding the other side. Consider this. Every time we do an Avera, we sever one more of those strands. Every time we do a mitzvah, we strengthen it. But if we do too many Averas, that rope becomes weak. Eventually, the rope becomes so weak. Cut. That's guns and curries. You've got no relationship. You can tug. There's nothing there. There's no rope. He says, then what do you do? He says, you have to tie a knot in the rope. But if you tie a knot in the rope's shorter. It was shorter than it ever was. This is a zach of the Balatanya. Now you're closer to Rabbeinu Sholem than you ever were. But you have to tie a rope. You have to tie a knot. Tying a knot means that you create a synergy between two disparate realities. You have to connect them. You want to keep into your world of Avaras and throw that away. There's no rope anymore. You have to bring your rope of Avaras back and put it there, on the Mizbeach, so to speak. It's a bit of a chah.
Is this like coping strategies?
I don't think it's coping strategies. I think it's an authentic medium of teshuvah. I think that's what teshuvah is. Teshuvah is an integration of your past and present in a way in which the past is not, it's not a horror story. The past is the best version of you. You know what it is? I mean, this is what the Gemara says. It's a schus. It's schuyot. But it can only be a schus if it sheds light on now. If it's always this embarrassing under the bed story, so then it's not a schus.
When you clap all faith on it, right?
Yeah.
That's embarrassing.
Yeah. But it's embarrassing in terms of the contrast to you are now. Bush is not a bad thing. But it's on the other hand, it's a certain sense of at least it's gearing me to something. And then when you've done your teshuvah and it's finished, now what's your relationship to the past? Is it an embarrassing past? Or is it a past that on some level like really, really got me to where I am? And that's a mentality shift. It's a total paradigm shift. It's not like a... It's not a busha anymore.
But you can see that it did get you to where you are. Yeah. Where you are, okay. But still, it's one again of itself. It's still embarrassing.
Yes. But again, it's more to whatever extent it's embarrassing conceptually, it could create a certain sense of intellectual, emotional rejection. In other words, I don't want to face it because it's embarrassing. If it's embarrassing, it doesn't lead you to the tools that you acquired in that process to get you to where you are now. So then a person can be a Gansan Baal Teshuvah. He's gone through this whole process. He's standing upon in front of a youngster. The guy's 20 years old. He's in the same place you were just two decades back. And you have no cooking clear open. And you do. You have your whole world has the ability to shed light on him. But the reflection has been so battered into the ground that you can't reflect on it on any level. It's just like it's irrelevant to you anymore. It's like you're another human being. It's just another life. So Rav Leuchter says that's disingenuous. And it's also in a certain sense removes the kedusha that you've attained now. Then you're a tzaddik amur. You're not a baal teshuvah. But as I said, the Tzaddik Gamor is not the same as the Baal Teshuva. Baal Teshuva has a certain place because he has a certain relationship to those Nekudas that a Tzaddik Gamor can't have. That's a Chab. And that's what we have to use. We have to use it. That is our arsenal. So all I wanted to say is this. When we now, if a person were to want to take on the responsibility of serving Am Yisrael in terms of Makariving a Yid, that process can't be done through using gimmicks. You must just use you. Be the most authentic version of yourself and show them your process. Again, it doesn't have to be about explicit exposure. I think it's much more about just the principles and those principles being reflected in yourself. I think the more gimmicky, the more inauthentic, and the more it won't resonate with someone else. It just has to be yourself. But again, for a lot of people, that's like beyond a distant memory. It's just like it was another life. So again, does that mean that a person has to now go back into the world of Averis? That's also not the pshat. It has to be the principles. A person doesn't have to go back into a shmutz. But the principles, that's you. That's your strength. That's your koach. That's exactly why you are you. So in a sense, that's the shofar. That's what he wanted to say the shofar is. The shofar is the ore which is machalek between the two worlds. It's the ability to contrast. If you aren't able to contrast in yourself what is the difference in a very, very purest way, so then you're not as close. And that's the difference between Teshuvah Me'ava and Teshuvah Me'ira. You know what Teshuvah Me'ira is? Teshuvah Me'ira means, really, I still want to do the Avera. I'm just scared. I'm scared that Hashem is going to hurt me. He's going to hurt someone I love. So I'm going to now do Teshuvah. So then it becomes a Zadoin. Then it can, all the Zadoinus can now turn into Shkagos. Because you did it by mistake, because you don't want to do it again. You're too scared. But if you do Teshuvah Me'av, that means that it resonates with you now. This relationship to the mitzvah is so deeply resonates. So then the process of the breakdown actually enabled that connection which was unavailable and inaccessible before. Then it's a schus. That's the pshat in the kamon. Just as an aside, but it really connects to the same principle. And I think that this is important in terms of, again, our own personal process of teshuvah, but with others as well. Everybody, yeah, because of your experience in both current, you see the big bracha of our community is nobody here lands up becoming so disassociated from the modern or secular world that it becomes very difficult to recalibrate to what a person's going through in a growthful process of teshuvah. So a person's not always out of the fold. We all got to work and we're all in this world. So what I feel is very important is this, is that when a person relates to a person going through this process, they need to just see not only a reflection of your own personal growth and the principles, which is what we've covered until now, but they need to see a sophisticated individual. There's nothing more impressive to a person who's not frum than seeing a person who is frum, who can straddle both worlds. And straddle both worlds doesn't mean that they're disingenuous or that they're a sellout. Straddle both worlds means that they can contribute on a societal level, they can be successful, they can be sophisticated, they understand things in the world, and yet they actually have a deep, deep, unapologetic appreciation of Torah and mitzvahs. That to a person in the secular context is profound, because there's a stereotype, and the stereotype is that if you're a person in the frum world, you're basically a nebuch. That's the stereotype. And by you breaking that stereotype, it's almost doing half the job. So it's an amazing thing. You have a yarmulke, and you bring a person into your home for Shabbos, and you give off the impression that you're matzliach, or that you understand life. That you're matzliach. You understand life in various ways. It's mind-boggling to a person in a secular context. Because they feel, until then, status quo is, this person's basically got blinkers on. They're totally, totally one-dimensional and narrow-minded. And even within a Torah concept, it's the Torah that they assume you know is not even that profound. So if you're able to show them a richness in various areas of your life, that to a person in that context is mind-boggling and very, very, it's very natural to gravitate towards that. It's attractive. It's extremely attractive. And that, again, isn't something that has to be contrived. You don't have to make it up. Just speak about what you're into. That's enough. Again, the more contrived and the more artificial, the more it's not going to be resonating with the other person. All you have to talk about is your business and aspirations, your whatever else you're interested in, if you're musical, if you're into animals, if you're into sport. But you see, it creates a bridge, but besides creating a bridge, in my mind, it creates an authentic version of what he could see himself being himself. Because until now, he doesn't want to be from. He doesn't want to not be from just because he doesn't want to do mitzvahs. He doesn't want to not be from because he thinks he has to give up being invested in the world. And he thinks by being from, I basically have to become impoverished, and I have to become basically very, very disinvested in anything that I'm familiar with. So if you're able to reorientate that perception, that's really half the battle, and it doesn't have to be through anything but a reflection of your own self. That's another experience that's been profound through the process of what we've seen in terms of our involvement with the Chevra. Rav Hutner used to say this. It's so beautiful. Rav Hutner used to say, right in Mikhtavim, he said, whatever you do in life, be sophisticated. He said, you don't have to do everything al yaday kodesh, which maybe that sounds like heresy today. Rav Moshe's daughter, Rav Moshe Shapiro Zatzal's daughter, came to us for Friday night supper. She's one of the leading psychotherapists and in neuro-infant development, basically the brain of a child. She speaks every single week of the year in a different country. She's one of the most impressive minds in our world. So she said to me, Rav Hutner used to call her in when they were living in New York. She used to call her in to talk in music. Fascinating. Number one, he called her in. Number two, they had a relationship. Rav Moshe also used to teach in Yeshiva Pachad Yitzchak in Yerushalayim. So they knew each other. But he would talk to her only in music. He wanted to talk to her in composition and in the sophistication of music. I thought, that's such a chap. Like that you can live in a world in where there's a richness. There's a richness to everything. So he said, if you want to be mashpia and someone else, just show them sophistication. It doesn't have to be even in the context of a toisis. Rav Soloveitchik in Harei Kedem says, teach them ksois and asivis, the most sophisticated areas of Choshen Mishpat, the best achronim, teach them that. Teach them sophisticated Torah. But Rav Hutner is saying something even more left of that. He's saying just show them sophistication. And he's saying that not just to makarov someone, he's saying it for yourself. Be sophisticated. If you want to get into art, but understand it. So you can be mavil bein a Rembrandt to a matrix art project. And it's not just all the same as us. Yeah, it's all the same.
What is to be sophisticated?
It means that you understand it. It says you have a depth. You have an amkut in a way in which there's a real erich. There's a real appreciation. There's a real sense of something. Because then you're giving them, so this is the chab, you're giving them the aspiration for amkut, the aspiration for depth. Because everything into the modern world today is not just quick fix, and artificial and superficial. It has zero sense of process and sophistication. Zero. There's not one thing recreational today that reflects sophistication. It's all gimmicky. Even if you have, like, you know what will go viral on the social media? It will have a guy who will today be able to take balls and juggle them. And then not only can he juggle them, he can drop them on the keys of a piano very, very accurately in order to play Beethoven. That's our world today. It's the recreation of Beethoven through dropping balls onto piano keys in a way in which there's a stylistic degree of coordination. But that's all it is. But there's no more Beethoven.
It's an application. I got it here.
That's right.
Children.
That's right. It's a ringtone. But that's a gap. But if they see that there's this interest in something real of substance, even if it's in sports, like I'm saying that you know the stats, if that's your thing, I'm saying you know, or you know the dynamic of tactics and so forth. Suddenly, I don't know, but it means being sophisticated. You don't have to reorientate yourself. No one here has an interest in Mozart, so don't go into Mozart. But at least within your area, have a sophistication. Because that reflects itself in every other experience in life. It makes you into a mensch. And like it brings out the ben adam in a person when they have a certain amkus in the experiences. So that was another reflection of mine that I think is so contagious and so attractive in terms of the bridging of the gaps.
The other side always want to make out like when one's a hypocrite and then you, when one is relying on religion as a stick.
As a crutch. Yeah.
We by throwing the sophistication in, you pass that, you knock that out.
You're not a nebuch. But the only way you can do it is if that's your world. And you can reflect that world to the extent you want. Okay, in summary, what I'd like to suggest is that this process of kiruv and outreach, I think is a poor terminology. I think it's a poor terminology because outreach suggests that these people are a project. And they're a project which is similar to welfare. And it dehumanizes them. And more than dehumanizes, it's condescending to say to another person, I'm in an outreach project to try and reach out to. If a person's in a situation of genuine desperate need, and they're willing to recognize that same principle, that's one thing. But in this world, by using that terminology, you're really suggesting that you're in a bigger position than them. And who's to say? As I mentioned at the first point, the mitzvah of teshuvah is for everybody. And Hashem has His own cheshbonos. So when one sees that first point, that was point number one. Point number two is within this framework, is we better be conscious of other people because kol Yisrael ravim zeh bazeh. And if we don't have an interest in the tzibur, we don't have an interest in the people outside of our dalet amos, so then we're never going to see Mashiach, and we're never going to be able to ultimately get anything to the extent we want to happen in this world. So we have to be involved in it. We can't run away from it. And the biggest proponent of it today, you should just know, in the whole world, are the Gedolei Torah. It's not like that this is like some sort of fringe stream of people that are saying, you know, to, being involved in Kiruv and getting involved in the Amcha, that's like, it's peripheral, it's fringe, it's controversial. It's not controversial. Rav Yaakov Hillel's just written a Kuntras. I've got the Sefer at home. He's one of his biggest articles in the book is on doing Teshuvah and the process of Teshuvah. And that's his biggest undertaking in life. And he's the biggest Mekubal in life. And if it's not him, at the last convention where Rav David Cohen, who's one of the Gedolim in America, was there with Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky. And Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky says, this is what people have to be involved in today. So it's not this is not fringe. This is our Christ. This is our Christ. You know, this is Rav Arbach's shir before. But you should just know that the Shulchan Aruch says that if a person, a child, is going to be taken on by Goyim, not killed, not threatened on any level, just to be taken, he's being captured by Goyim to live a Goy Shalaf. If you can save a yid from being captured by Goyim, you mechuyiv to break Shabbos in order to save. That's a beferish machabe in Shulchan Aruch. And very few people know. In other words, pikuach nefesh is not just a din on the guf. Pikuach nefesh is a din by the neshoma. To save a neshoma is same as saving the guf. So you see a yid drowning and you walk past, you think you're the biggest achzar in the world. You're beyond cruel. But the yidin are drowning now. So I'm going to put that
there. I went to King David Encounter. I didn't want this to be recorded. We give a talk on interdating over there. The one group, the massive group. This is King David, classic traditional South African Jewry. Out of the group, they were asked, who here wants to marry Jewish? Put up your hand. Three people go up there. We're on the cusp of a South African Jewish genocide. And like we all are kind of resting on our laurels on the assumption that what happened in the 90s is the same reality as what's happening now. And if anything, it's even getting better because Awesome's doing so well. And I'd be like, yeah, I'm not going to be much there.
reality is everyone's losing the battle on a major scale. And more people are marrying out. But of all my friends, I'm King David graduate, half of them are married out. And don't even have the slightest remorse. It's normal. Everything's normalizing. This is a reality that requires us, if we have the wherewithal, to be much more hands-on. Not hands-on again in a project way. Hands-on in a way in which this is the destiny of Am Yisrael. Either we're going to... I didn't want to say that because that sounds like we're accusatory of King David, which it is.
Yeah, why not?
Because my main feeder. But the reality is this. 80 King Davidian, Grady Nevins and are coming to us. 80 King Davidians are coming to us on a Thursday night. Tonight we have a Victory Park. And then the rest of the night we have university students. Every single night we have people coming in and we're losing. And we're like killing it in terms of numbers, but half the people in the rest of the community aren't being reached. It's the reality. And we need more people. We need more people. We need more money. We need more people to take us on. But the reality is this. I don't want to give a pitch on that level. What I want to become and communicate in terms of bridging the gaps is there's no gap to bridge. This is our world. We've gone through it ourselves. And more so than that, that's the underlying requirement of our process this level, is to use and experience the process of Bina. Bina means reflecting on your process that you've gone through and using it to galvanize greater connection to Hashem and tradition. But not running away. If you run away, you don't use it. Then it's Teshuvah Me'ira. Teshuvah Me'ira means you relate to your process. And you use it to bolster you forward to have deeper connections. Then you're in a makom that even a tzaddik gadol can't stand. And then you're positioned in a way in which you can be the best tool to expose yourself to someone else. And they can just walk in your footsteps. They can just see you as a role model, that's all. For two reasons. You're a role model because you've gone through a process yourself, but you're a role model because you represent a more sophisticated version of them. They see you now as a mentor and as a person that they really want to aspire to be. But that's because you expose them to also the fact that you're involved in the world, and that part of you is actually sophisticated. In many ways, both commercially, economically, and recreationally. And the more they see, so to speak, a chochem in that area, the more they just want to be. That's the best organic self that one can achieve in order to be mashpia on others. As Ras Hashem, this edel should be an edel in where we feel the need to reach out to a lot of drowning yidden, but at the same time to rescue ourselves. Rescue ourselves from denial, and rescue ourselves from being abandoning the past. The past that has made us our real, real best version of self. So that, please God, when you stand in front of the Rabbeinu Shoylan, we took that rope that really was either very, very loose or broken, and now there's a real knot. And you're so much closer than anybody around you that never had the schus to go through the same process. Thank you.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.